Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hi there, podcast fans. I'm Tom Gibbs. Welcome to Telegraph Audio Football Club. We are back with you again for the very, very best and worst ever of football. Part three. Still don't have a proper name. The four categories we've got up for discussion today are number one, goalkeepers. Number two, mistakes. Number three, pundits. And number four, stadiums or stadia, if you're staying true to the Latin route, which you're very welcome to do. Let's take you now into a series of remote audio recording facilities where I'm joined first and foremost by Mina Rizuki. What's happening, Mina?
I'm trying really hard to hold in a cough, but I'm doing good. Okay. Thank you.
That's good. That's good. Alongside her today, we have JJ Ball. How are you, JJ?
Good evening.
Evening.
I don't know. I'm fine.
Are you sure?
Nope. All is good. What a good world. Yeah,
it sounds like you've maintained your sanity. We're recording at 10 past 10 on a Tuesday to be opening with good evening. Suggest to me someone in the
prime of their mental health. Is the call around here?
Alongside JJ today, we have Sam Dean. How are you, Sam?
I'm good. Pleased to be back. It's been a long while. I really like the new artwork on the podcast. I think it really captures the essence of the podcast. And there's There's definitely not any space for a third face on it. So I think it, as it is perfect.
Good. Yeah, glad you're on board with us, Sam. Let's start with you, Sam, and our first category today, which is a big one, and it's goalkeepers. And you've picked your best ever goalkeeper. Who have you chosen and why?
We should always feel uncomfortable with, like, oh, best ever, worst ever, like, ever, well, of all time.
You're really going to struggle with the concept of this podcast. That's something you're not happy with.
So I'm not entirely convinced that Manuel Neuer, who's my pick, is the best goalkeeper ever. But what I am convinced of is that he is the most revolutionary goalkeeper, at least of the 21st century, and I'm pretty sure going further back. So he may not be the absolute best, but I think he's the biggest game changer. And you look now, even sort of 5 or 6 years on from his peak, really, which was 2014 World Cup and when Pep Guardiola was at Bayern Munich, and you see so many goalkeepers now playing the way he did as a sweeper keeper, being adventurous with his passing. And you just look across leagues in Europe, and particularly in the Premier League, where the two best goalies are Alisson, who pretty much plays the same way that Neuer did, and Ederson, who, again, very similar. And I think that's sort of testament to Neuer's quality, to Pep Guardiola's innovation, and the fact that Neuer basically changed the game with his insane sweeping keeping, if you will. I was looking back at the highlights of, I think the most famous example of this is when they played Algeria in the round of 16 of the 2014 World Cup. And Neuer was literally everywhere. He was, if you look at his heat map from that game, he was literally across the whole of the final third of Germany. He was coming out, making tackles all game, making headed clearances. He pretty much didn't touch the ball in his own box because he was too busy winning it about 40 yards from his goal. And that was sort of, you know, I think that made the world really sit up and notice that this guy was doing something completely different. And for that reason alone, I think he sits at the top of my pile.
Like, I just don't get it with Neuer. I'm one of those, maybe because I'm one of those types of people who has Schadenfreude when he makes a mistake, yeah. But, like, everyone keeps talking about that Algeria game, and all I want to say is it's Algeria. You don't have to, you know, you don't have the gung-ho to do this against a team that's like Spain, and then I'd be like, yeah, okay, fine. But, you know, you could do it. You could afford to do this against Algeria. And yes, he can be capable of the sublime, but he can also be capable of the kind of the bit of the ridiculous. Like, do you remember that huge mistake against South Korea in the last World Cup? Or about, I don't know, against Paderborn, like a few weeks ago? He's just one of those guys that, like, I get it that he does, like, some really great things, and he isn't revolutionary. I mean, 1974, Holland's goalkeeper, I don't even know how to pronounce his name, Jan Jong Bloot. That was the first time, like, or one of the many first times that we saw a guy who changed football or revolutionized a position, and he was actually rather bad for a long time. But obviously, you know, Rinus Michels wanted to do something different and decided to go for someone who used that. And then there was René Higuita, which we'll get to later because I'm using him as one of my examples. Jorge Campos in Mexico. There were loads of guys that were sweeper keepers. One of the reasons why it didn't last that long is because they can be capable of the ridiculous. So I don't know. I'm just not a fan of Neuer at all.
Isn't there an argument that Neuer just did it so much better than all of those other keepers? We will get to Higuita, as you say, but I think when you think about that 2014 World Cup, he just had so much about him. So much about goalkeeping is about confidence and projecting that towards your backline. And he managed to do that while also making all of these adventurous decisions about where to go to the ball and the positions to take up on the pitch.
Yeah, you're right about that. And Sam's also right about the fact that he's, like, inspired generations of goalkeepers who now try to play like him in a way that perhaps some of the others didn't. But I still think that it's got a temporary shelf life. I still think classic sort of goalkeeping to a certain extent offers you a lot more security. And I do think that sometimes, you know, when you have to have the confidence, but then you have almost too much confidence in the way that he was, for example, in the World Cup against South Korea. And that's only 4 years on from his marvelous play against Algeria. And it was the World Cup in which, like, I mean, Brazil lost 7-0. So, I mean, there were some really weird moments in that World Cup as well. You have to have the confidence, but you're also capable of having too much of it and then doing some diabolical mistakes. It's also, can I also mention, that Neuer is just not a lovable figure in general. I think Ter Stegen should be there right now, and I feel like he's keeping him out as well. And also, you just, you know, he says these comments like, oh, I didn't know that Sergio Ramos likes to take his penalties in space or whatever it is that he said at the time, or sky them so high. He's not one of those guys that you just want to be like, yeah, in the way that Alisson or Edison maybe are a little bit more. So I don't know whether it's just a Neuer thing or it's just a position that annoys me. I don't know.
All right, Mina, well, who have you nominated for your best keeper? Is he a lovable character?
Yes, it's Buffon. Because I feel like Sam's going to be like, okay, now listen here. Because Buffon has made so many mistakes recently. I've gone for a guy who, I think it's between him and people say Lev Yashin, but obviously I haven't watched him. I know I like my old school football, but I haven't gone that far back. But
Yashin was also a sweeper keeper, the kind you were just this like a Neuer off for.
There we go. I haven't really watched much of Lev Yashin, so I have no clue about him in the sense that at least I've watched 1974 final or whatever, so I can talk about that a little bit more. But
yeah,
they say he was the best. And then Dino Zoff was the best in Italy for many years. But for me, it's Gianluigi Buffon. I like somebody who's a lot more classic, great reflexes. I do say the one caveat to Buffon is that he's always been blessed with a really great defensive line. He's always had some really good defenders ahead of him, which is something that I can't say for many of the goalkeepers that I've admired over the years. I don't know. I mean, Schmeichel was blessed at some point as well, actually. But he did always have, you know, the likes of Cannavaro, Lilian Thuram, you know, Giorgio Chiellini, Bonucci now. He did always have some great people ahead of him, so it becomes a little bit easier to assert his authority. But it was his positioning. It was that ridiculous World Cup in 2006 where the only thing he conceded was an own goal, and obviously Zinedine Zidane's ridiculously beautiful penalty in the final. And I just love the way that he's changed his game, the way that he's sort of adapted, because as you get older, you sort of lose your reflexes. So his positioning now is so fantastic. His leadership, the fact that when Juventus went down to Serie B with all of their problems and scandals, he decided to stay with them. He's a guy who spoke about mental health issues. He's been very open about the fact that he went through serious depression when he was 26, and he had everything going for him at that time, and yet was still suffering. And he spoke about that a lot, which inspired so many people at the time in Italy to come out and focus on this issue and address it themselves. And I don't know, he's not just a good goalkeeper, he's a good man and quite beloved. I've had my issues with him in the sense that he doesn't seem to ever want to retire. And sometimes he's almost too nice. And then, of course, you know, in 2018, was it, when he had that, it was the quarterfinals against Real Madrid, and he just lost his mind against Michael Oliver, which is like the first time I'd seen him be really competitive in a game in some time.
But that is one of the all-time great insults. Saying that you have a rubbish bin for a heart. I mean, it's just exceptional.
The translation is perfect as well, isn't it? The way that comes across.
Who have you got, JJ? Does your goalkeeper have a rubbish bin for a heart?
No, he has fire for a heart. Peter Schmeichel.
Yeah, great shout.
Yeah, I mean, it's whenever you choose one of your best ever 11s that you watch play, I always put Schmeichel in as the goalie. I think if I was actually choosing a team, I was really going to play on the pitch, I'd have someone like Neuer who can play with the ball. The kind of guy, Guardiola had plans to actually put him in midfield once Bayern won the league in Bundesliga. According to Rummenigge, that's a real thing. But yeah, Schmeichel was, it felt like there was a massive block in the middle of the goal. Like it, yeah, he seemed bigger than he was, as though he had extra height and width, and I can't imagine what it was like playing against that. He was so super confident that it must have come across on the pitch. And I like that he used to battle Roy Keane. Roy Keane has had some interesting things to say about him recently, and how they definitely didn't get on, but that he seemed to quite enjoy that, and it helped fuel that competitive spirit within the Manchester United dressing room that helped them win everything. But yeah, he was great. Also, he scored, which makes him win extra points.
Well, tell you what, JJ, my nomination for this position is José Chilavert, who scored, but scored 67 goals in his career. What more can you ask for than a goalkeeper who takes a brilliant free kick?
Penalties too.
Exactly. Well, he once scored a hat-trick of penalties, 1999. And if you look at them, they're on YouTube. Each of them is harder than the last one. He's like a South American Julian Dix. And I love his nickname as well, El Bulldog. Which translates as the bulldog. And he wasn't just a curio either, Chilavert. Obviously, we remember him as this goal-scoring goalkeeper who could take free kicks and penalties, but he was actually named best keeper in the world three times in the 90s, ahead of Bartosz, Schmeichel and Peruzzi, the Italian keeper. So, you know, it's hard to be an exciting goalkeeper, isn't it? But he's my pick for this question.
Strange added fact on Chilavert is that back in the days of online chat rooms, if you remember those, I used to go on there when the internet was a thing that you dialed up, and I once went in a chat room and I was just chatting to someone random, and I pretended to be a Sunderland youth player, don't know why, and turns out at the time I was talking to José Luis Chilavert.
Really?
And it took me about 6 years to realise it wasn't.
Yes, yeah. There was very little chance that was
Chilavert. It was a long, long time. I didn't at the time question why someone who would naturally speak Spanish was conversing with probably a 10-year-old on the internet. Good times. Good times.
Somewhere in the Basque Country, there's a guy on a podcast right now saying he's once on a chat room and he came across a Sunderland youth player and he couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. It's one of those lovely, wholesome stories of anonymous chat with 10-year-old boys on the internet.
This is taking a really weird turn.
Yeah, agreed, Mina. Let's move on, Mina, to the next category, which is mistakes. And you've nominated your worst mistake ever. What is it and why?
It's funny how when you think of a mistake, you kind of always think of a goalkeeper. It has to be the World Cup, since I love to go for all my retro World Cups. and it was Rene Higuita versus Cameroon, when once again he forgot that he's a goalkeeper and played like an outfield player, and he was this time up against Roger Miller, and who at that time had the wisdom and the understanding to know how to rob him off the ball, score, and send Cameroon through, obviously, like, dooming Higuita to one of the worst mistakes of his career. And it was really funny, actually, because the Tim Vickery was speaking about this, because there was a picture of the horrendous accident going around in sort of mid-March, late March, going, oh, God, does everyone remember this in the World Cup 90 when, you know, there was that hideous mistake from Higuita, who was the sweeper keeper. And he was like, and someone had captioned the photo with something along the lines of, if you're told not to go out, don't go out, in relation to the quarantine. and so he, you know, being like, you know, good guy that he is, he basically was like, well, if this photo like serves to basically make you guys realize that we need to stay home, then I'm going to use it as well as I could, as well as I can, and health comes first, basically. Which I thought was a really good way of like sort of wrapping everything up and in a nice bow. So probably that mistake. But what's really interesting is that, you know, it's one of the most famous mistakes he's ever made. And obviously, like, one of the mistakes always noted about Colombia could have reached further with him. But if you ask the coach at the time, he was like, whatever happens, he was the man that led us here. He was the, you know, an amazing goalkeeper because of his ability with his feet. I always had 11 outfield players with him on the side. But of course, when you do have 11 outfield players, there is that giant mistake in them that could knock you out as well. So it's kind of like a fine balance.
Do you think there's ever a time for showboating from a goalkeeper? I mean, obviously, we remember Higuita in this country for the scorpion kick at Wembley, which took place in a friendly, which I think was might have been a nil or draw. It was certainly not a high-stakes game. You don't want to see your goalkeeper 40 yards from his goal doing a little pirouette turn in the round of 16.
I do.
World Cup,
do you? I absolutely do.
Yeah, JJ does.
Have you seen that advert with Higuita doing... it's an advert for like a Colombian orange drink in which he just arrives in the supermarket and the kids are all delighted to see him.
No.
I'll send it around. This? We'll put it in the show notes. It's late 90s. It's a thing of absolute wonder.
Me gusta Higuita. Ya vengo, papá. Con Frutinho, tú vives el sabor ganador. Con Frutinho, lo fresco de hoy. Frutinho, delicioso sabor.
De pura frescura.
Oh, God, he was so, like, the scorpion kick is something that I don't think I'll ever forget. It was just like one of those, wait, what just happened?
Yeah. Absolutely. Felt like a glitch in the Matrix. What have you got for mistake, JJ?
It's funny every single time you watch it, and it is John Terry's penalty miss in the 2008 Champions League final. I just watched it again right now, and I had to move away from the mic so as not to laugh over. It's everything about it is perfect. Like the stage, so Chelsea desperate to get that Champions League win against Man United. You know they're equally keen to get it, obviously. But the fact that it's the fifth penalty, so it's the potential winner, because Ronaldo has already missed, so the star of the show has missed. And then, surely he wasn't... I haven't read into it enough, but I can't imagine John Terry was lined up to be the fifth penalty taker. But of course, he has to be the fifth penalty taker. It means that he can win the Champions League final for Chelsea. The captain, heroic, and up he steps. And oh my, and he adjusts his captain's armband and he puts down the ball, and the camera angle when they showed it was behind the penalty taker, and he slips at the perfect time, but like a banana skin style slip, and the ball goes flying wide, and then he instantly puts his head between his legs, looks like he's about to cry. It's so funny. I mean, I'm sure Chelsea fans don't agree, but yeah. Everything about it. Is this giant hero of a self-worth of a man suddenly reduced to realising that he has completely goosed it.
Mr. Chelsea, who has felt the pain of the semi-final defeats in the Champions League for Chelsea, has the chance to win the Champions League for Chelsea. And there's a chance that has passed him by.
I agree with you, JJ. highly, highly amusing. What's worse from Terry, missing that penalty or getting changed into his kit to celebrate in 2012?
The kit.
The kit's kind of...
I think the kit's worse. The kit, there's no explanation for that. We can all fall over. It can happen. The kit requires a conscious effort.
But he's thinking of the photographs in the future. You'll look back on that in years and years and years, and then only... I mean, the thing is, we do remember, because it's been pointed out how funny it is. The penalty is really good, though. Honestly, watch it again. I'm not... If you're a Chelsea fan, I'm sure you're gutted, but it's great.
It was like the pouring rain, wasn't it? Like, it was like downpour, and it's sort of mingled with his tears as it sort of streaks down his face, and it's like a sort of a Hollywood film, like, coming to an end.
That's it. It's sort of getting an
old stereo on his shoulders and going outside his girlfriend's house.
It's because of that dramatic ending to it. It's the way it's like the crescendo of it's the final part of the movie. This is the perfect thing. It's the whole summation of his entire life's work. This one moment, and he slips.
It's quite Shawshank Redemption, but without the redemption. You're a cruel man, JJ. I've also picked a mistake in a Champions League final, and it was Loris Karius for Liverpool. I just think his entire career will be defined by the mistake in that game. And to have got it so badly wrong that you're just bombed out of the club immediately afterwards, to have made a mistake that big, or it's like, well, we've just given up on you. I mean, he's still owned by Liverpool. He's still only 26. He does have, I suppose, some time to rebuild his reputation, but it just... I think when we look back on the career of Loris Karius, there's only going to be one thing in our minds. Another goalkeeper for you, Sam. Who have you gone for?
I've gone for Robert Green. Not because it's the worst actual, like, the most egregious error, but what the error meant and the context of it. Obviously, I'm talking about the World Cup 2010, England's first game. You have to remember that England went into that tournament as many people's favourites. Lionel Messi had said that England were his favourites for the tournament. We were quality. Under Capello, we qualified, like, at an absolute canter. Rooney was banging in goals. Lampard was good. They found a system with Gerrard off the left that worked. We took the lead against USA after 4 minutes. And at that point, after 4 minutes of the World Cup, I think the whole nation was pretty much convinced we were going to win the thing. And then Rob Green does that. It goes to 1-1. We start locking up a bit, seizing up, and the whole World Cup goes downhill from there. And obviously, if we had won that game, we would have got through, and USA hadn't scored a last minute winner in their final group game, we would have got through into the next round, the knockout stages. And rather than play Germany, when we famously got absolutely battered 4-1 and Mesut Ozil essentially retired Gareth Barry, we would have played Ghana. And if we beat Ghana, it would have been Uruguay, and if we beat Uruguay, it would have been the Netherlands. So we could have been in the semi-final with arguably the best team that England have produced in the last 20 years. Yet it all went wrong. But we didn't, because it all went wrong, and it all went wrong from one point, and that was the point at which Rob Green threw Clint Dempsey's daisy cutter into the back of his neck.
I've got a little bit to say about your projection of how 2010 would have turned out had Rob Green not let that in, Sam. I think you're forgetting that horrible nil-all with Algeria afterwards.
Yeah, but that was a consequence of the locking up. If we'd won that first game, there'd be less pressure. And you remember Rooney got at the end of that 0-0 with Algeria, Rooney slagging off his own fans, everyone was jeering and booing. It all stemmed from the error by Rob. And that was the turning point. You could also probably say that Rio Ferdinand getting injured as the captain beforehand didn't help. But we had a team that was, like, on fire before that tournament, and Rob Green poured water all over it.
Dempsey, one of the stars of the Confederations Cup, testing Green again. Oh, what an error! What an awful moment for Rob Green and for England. Presented Clint Dempsey with an American equaliser. Taste some getting over.
Let's move on now to talking about pundits, and you've nominated your best pundit ever. Why have you chosen who you've chosen, JJ?
Gary Neville, because he's great, and I think he's changed a lot of how people approach punditry. I think when he started doing it in Sky Sports, one of the things I like about him is you'll notice when they ask him a question, he'll often take a beat, breathe, and then answer it, rather than just coming out with the first thing that reacts that comes off his head. And what that does is allow him to say things that he really thinks in a normal person's voice, rather than adopt a TV personality, like a performance. A lot of people say the same things, the same cliches. You can pretty much write a script for every single end of match or halftime analysis, because pundits have traditionally followed a set, there's like a song, everyone just hits the same notes and there's the melody they follow and the rhythm and then that's it. Whereas Neville says things that he thinks as though he was saying to someone in the pub, and I really appreciate it, but he's also able to impart knowledge that he has. And as someone who, he's maybe not the most gifted technical player, he was someone who worked very hard, understood what he was doing, he's very good mentally, and that comes across in the things he says, which means that when he talks, people listen. And he's also seems to work very hard at it, to get good at it. And you can tell with Monday Night Football, the way that's been revived since he took it over, you saw him try to make it a bit more like American sports coverage, using data and going through games to point out things that hadn't been done before. It's just looking for a way to do it that is different to everyone else, working harder to make sure that it keeps up the quality level, and doing it in a way that isn't forced, nor comes across as an easy... He hasn't done it the easy way. He could easily have done what Shearer did when he first came on to Match of the Day and just turn up, say what you see and get on with it. Whereas Neville has had to work hard to make sure that he has channeled out a real niche for what he's done, which has become sort of standard.
Do you think his reputation as a pundit was undermined in any way by how badly it went for him as a manager at Valencia?
No, because I think he's handled that quite well, and he uses examples of what he did there and what he was trying to achieve. I think it probably helps him as a pundit that he can see the other side of it, and he can talk about things. He won't just rush to say this person should be fired, or that should happen, or this could happen, because he sort of has experience now of what that's actually like to be in it. So if anything, I'd say it's improved his punditry. I don't think it's harmed him that he's done that. No, I don't think so at all.
I think this is obviously, co-commentary is a bit different to punditry, and I completely agree with what you're saying, JJ. I think I always find when I watch back like old Premier League years or old goals from before, even sort of in the mid-noughties when you've got Andy Gray on the punditry and stuff, you can really see how much that's changed when like a great goal goes in and Andy Gray would just say, oh, brilliant hit. I mean, you don't save those. What a player this guy is. Whereas these days now, and I think Neville's played a big part in this, there's actually like a desire to explain things and analyse things live as it happens. And when Neville's a co-commentator, I think he's brilliant. And he'll sort of point out where a goal was sort of starting from or the position of the goal, rather than just saying, oh, brilliant strike, which is pretty much the way it was done for, I think, about 15, 20 years before Neville came along.
It's interesting with Gary Neville, isn't it? Because he obviously had a very, very successful career at the highest level, played for his country, won the league title loads of times, and he's a brilliant pundit. My nomination is for the worst pundit, and it's Paul Scholes, because he famously hated talking while he was a player. So why do we think he's going to be a big pundit? And I think he speaks to a problem we've got with punditry, which is it just goes to the biggest, most famous names a lot of the time. And I'm not sure that there is enough work that goes into finding those voices that perhaps didn't have the stellar career, but are just more suited to being able to express themselves well. And you look at someone like Pat Nevin on Five Live, who was a very famous, well-known player in his day, but not at the very top level like Scholes or Neville. And I think there's probably this huge untapped resource from players that aren't as well known, but it's I suppose it's a celebrity game, like much of the other the wider world, driven by celebrity and name recognition. Who have you got, Sam?
I think that the unexpected hero of the last sort of 10 years at least of punditry is Slaven Bilic. If you remember at the 2016 Euros and the 2018 World Cup, he was the absolute star of the show. He was brilliant. I was reading back some old sort of pieces about him, and the Telegraph described him as having the same vibe as a grungy rock star, which is definitely true. And like, he was just like honest, and Bilic has always been honest, which is one of his more endearing characteristics, but he's honest. He was quite blunt, and like, it was insight without turning it on too much. And obviously when you're on ITV, you have to appeal to a really wide audience. And obviously, as a Premier League manager at the time, during the Euros, he would have a great depth of knowledge on tactics and stuff, but he was able to convey that in a way that was quite understandable and digestible for the wider audience, rather than just sort of football keynotes like ourselves who would pay for Sky and BT, etc. And like, he was just, I think, you know, it was a great example at the World Cup 2018 when they were, the ITV panel was sort of discussing in great depth a VAR decision. And he just goes, oh, to be honest, I don't care. I think that actually summed up a lot of people's views on VAR at the time. There was so much chat about it. And like, just sort of cut to the point in quite an endearing way. And for that alone, and I, obviously it's different when you're only doing tournaments and stuff, but he was consistently really watchable. And I hope he'll be doing more and more of that at future tournaments too.
It's like Neville Noe with Bilic, that he speaks how he speaks and it breaks the conventional rules of what a pundit's supposed to do. So it seems kind of shocking and out of what you expect, but it then makes it for better TV. It seemed like, if you, you imagine a podcast where just pundits just rolling out cliches I heard from someone else, you'd stop listening to it. So why would you want to listen to the same tired pundits always doing the same bit over and over again when they do analysis? And I like that Bilic will talk as though he's not on TV.
And he'd also bring other people into conversation, just like turn and just ask a question as if you would in a normal conversation. Like,
exactly, yeah.
Just turn and bring them in, like, for something that's relevant, rather than waiting for the host to sort of allocate sort of topics to various people.
Mina Rizuki, I'm going to allocate a category to you, and it's punditry. Who have you got as the best ever pundit?
Oh, I was like, so in my mine is Jose Mourinho. For me, I thought that he was the only pundit on TV where I was like, all right, let me grab a paper and pen and like listen to what it is that he said, because it's like it's like a lesson in football. It's funny when you had him on and he would explain things and he'll, I don't know why, but when you think of Jose Mourinho, like, you know, you were saying how Slaven Bilic is so natural. Like, you know, he's if you were a host of a show, you'd really want Slaven Bilic, because he can sort of, you know, if you point to him or you look at him, he'll sort of dominate and he'll be entertaining and he'll give you everything. With Jose Mourinho, was like, you sort of expect exactly the same thing. You expect a little bit of fire, but instead he had this sort of wisdom about him. And when you would, like, you know, look to him, he would wait till everyone had their say, and then he would just come out with something that was just 10 times more profound than what, I don't know, Jamie Redknapp or Souness or whoever was alongside him would say. And it would just be to a level that was just, it was almost like he understood football better than anyone else. And he would talk about things like the principles of football, the tactics, and these are the two reasons why, or he'll say, I mean, for me, he just doesn't have that quality. And it would just have a certain gravitas when he would say it in comparison to what anyone else would be saying. Because a lot of the time what you get with these shows and a lot of the pundits is like, you know, I mean, it's a lot of like, I mean, it's a lot of complaining. Just get the ball into the box. I mean, that's all you need to do. Just get the ball into the box. But he'll explain sort of things that, you know, that they haven't mentioned before. And it was almost like you were like, oh my God, how did you not succeed at United? I spent most of my time watching him being like, I don't understand why it's been not so great for you in recent years, because you are clearly so above and all when it comes to understanding the game.
He finished. He finished second with United, and that was famously one of his best achievements. So that's not.
Well, now we look back on it, but at the time we were like complaining about him, and we're still complaining about him in Spurs, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I think he's probably a better pundit now than he is a manager. I think he should take up
that. Oh, that's.
I'm not having that. On the note of Mourinho as well, I'd say Joe Cole is really, really good and quite underrated. And I think it's because he's just at the end of doing it. He's working with Chelsea. I think it's the youth academy he works with. But he's doing his pro license or UEFA A. I'm not sure which badge he's on just at the moment. But you can tell he is doing actual coaching, because his analysis is of stuff he would be having to do for those coaching kind of courses, where he strips apart patterns of play, which is, again, something people don't generally do. They tend to just look at a player doing this or that and the researchers. So the way at TV is that often the researchers and the producers behind the scenes are the ones who do the actual research and then provide this footage, having talked with that pundit as to how they want to present that. But I think Joe Cole, who's the kind of player who comes across with his own ideas and what he's noticed and how he wants to implement that, and would know where the clips are to help produce that segment. And you can see it when he does things on BT Sport that he's dead good at it. Andy Hinchcliffe is relevant to you, Tom, saying how it tends to be the names rather than the standard of punditry. Andy Hinchcliffe, I think, is really underrated. Like Joe Cole, there's a lot of tactical analysis and a lot of player analysis stuff going off that you don't spot where the camera is following. And he's great for that kind of bits.
Can I just make a suggestion for the worst?
Yeah.
Yeah, go on.
Just quickly, do you remember in the 2014 World Cup when ITV had that studio on the beach and they got Fabio Cannavaro to sit on there?
Oh my God, he was so bad.
Is obviously what a legend and what a handsome guy, but he literally couldn't speak English.
It just did not work at all.
Go beyond the headlines with The Telegraph's daily coronavirus podcast, a roundup of the latest news on the pandemic from our leading journalists, with analysis on the impact on health, business and travel every weekday evening. Search Coronavirus The Latest on your podcast app.
Let's finish up with a discussion about stadiums, and I'm going to put forward my worst stadium ever. And I feel qualified to talk about this because I'm in the middle of doing the 92. I'm on to 81 of the 92. Who knows how many of the 92 will still exist by the time that football comes back, but hopefully all of them. The worst stadium for me is the Colchester Community Stadium of Colchester United. This is everything that's wrong with everything. It replaced Layer Road, which would not have been troubling this category as the best stadium ever. It was a pokey, grotty ground, but it was unique. It was quite close to the town centre of Colchester. The new stadium is completely the other side of town. It's miles away. There's nothing around it. It's more or less identical to Shrewsbury and Chesterfield, which were both built around the same time. It's got four bland, separate stands, which don't talk to each other in any way. There's no character. There's nothing to recommend it. What are Colchester United now? When they were in Layer Road, they got up to the Championship. They were scrapping. They had a bit about them. Now they're just stuck in anonymity in League Two with a stadium that no one likes to visit. I understand that clubs lower down the pyramid need their stadiums to work harder than just being used once a fortnight for football, but that doesn't mean I have to like it. You've gone for your best ever, Sam. What is it?
The Mestalla of Valencia.
Yes.
That's just like a proper old school, incredibly steep, bright orange seats. And I also went, I think it was late April, early May, and the sun was shining. It was about 25 degrees. It was just like an incredible experience, and when it was loud, it was properly, like, I know it's a cliche, but it was properly rocking. And I think the main thing that stands out is the steepness of it and the sort of history of it. It's old, you can feel it's old, but in a good way. But when you look down, you do genuinely feel a bit of sort of like your stomach tightening up a bit, because like you don't get it that steep in anywhere in England that I've seen. And steepness combined with weather combined with history, I think that makes for a proper stadium in my books.
Steeped in history, you could say. How about you?
Hey.
Steeped in history, yeah, San Siro. The Mestalla is a really good one, I have to say. San Siro, because of obviously like what it means, because it houses two of the biggest clubs in Italy. But it's also, I never know how to say this word, but it's a dichotomy. Is that right, how you say it?
Yes.
Yes, okay, thank you. It's one of those places where you, when you visit it, it's, you get such a clash of everything in it. Firstly, just before anything, is the acoustics you have in there. You've got like the glamour of, like, especially when the club, when Milan was owned by Berlusconi at the time. You had like all these, some of the world's most beautiful women, some of the Italy's richest people were coming in. There's this huge area that you know, the sort of the VIP area where Berlusconi used to sit, and Galliani and all of those. Even when Inter were playing, and Schneider's wife and all of them would come in, especially in 2010. It was just this really glamorous section that you had. And then you would have, you sort of turned and then you'd see all the ultras. And it was like CD, it was nasty, it was like a lot of the time there'd be fights taking place, although they would make the atmosphere so impossibly like wretched for the opponent, and you could feel almost the hatred. And it was especially prevalent when they had Fossa di Leone, which was the ultra group for Milan that's been disbanded since, but they would make life so miserable. And this was when Milan were Milan, you know, not the way that they are right now. And you would look at these two things and you'd see like the world's most beautiful women. And then you'd see these ultras like all like, you know, like hissing every time the opponent got the ball. And it was just like such an amazing contrast. And you'd feel all of it because it's almost stacked, the way that the San Siro is built. So it just captured all the noise, and the ground is always shaking. So if you had a glass of water, you had any sort of like drink, it was always shaking a little bit, like, you know, Godzilla is about to come in any second now, you know. And so you felt all of that in a game, and you'd walk out genuinely exhausted because you felt like you went through a journey. You didn't just go and watch a game like you do when you go to the Juventus Stadium or, you know, like the Emirates or whatever it is. This was just like, oh, that was a lot, you know, and it was like an outing, and it will always be like this, like historical thing that will be such a shame when it's, you know, taken away and no longer the pride of Milan, but things have to change.
I love the San Siro, but the one complaint I would make, and this is a very, maybe it's a bit niche complaint, but it is pretty much has been built in a car park.
Yeah.
Like, you're just like, you, it's not, there's no sort of nothing around it. It's just, a big block of concrete, which is empty. And then there's, you find a stadium there. Whereas some of the best stadiums, you sort of find them in the streets. And when you're walking through terrace houses and stuff.
It's quite far from your house as well.
Like the Bernabeu is so nice because it's in the middle of Madrid, you know, it's like in the middle of like daily life. But why that one, I mean, as much as I love it, the problem with Bernabeu is that it's not really about the stadium, but more about how what Madrid do in a big game and how like the whole city comes alive and carries like the buses, you know, to the stadium. And anyway, yeah, I don't know.
JJ, yours is in the middle of the streets. What have you picked?
Well, I went for the best stadium, and although, I mean, sure, everyone who supports a club would have their own one. I mean, I think Tawdry Aberdeen is the best, especially because of its location and all the history inside it. I absolutely love the Camp Nou in Barcelona. I have been to it 3 times, once to watch a game and twice to do the stadium tour.
You did the stadium tour twice? What were you getting out of it the second time?
Because it's so, I loved so much going down those stairs that you always see on Champions League games, and then walking up to the pitch. And I can, and you look up and it's enormous inside. It's enormous. And you can imagine, like, wow, thinking if, like, you're wearing a Barcelona shirt and you're walking out onto this pitch to play in front of all those people, the same pitch that Ronaldo used to play on, Messi plays on, Rivaldo, all, like, stories of all these boys that were there. Like, if you think of the history and how things like Johan Cruyff's teams changed how a lot of these things worked. And it's
so is
really,
it the stadium or is it Barcelona? Was it your imagination?
All of it. It's, the stadium encaptures it, isn't it? I mean, what's it? Old Trafford's called the Theatre of Dreams. You can attach a certain amount of imagination to these stadiums when you go in them. And I like looking at it when it's empty. It's weird. You know how you... I don't know if you've ever worked in bars before, but if you walk into like a nightclub that you go to a lot in your young 20s, it's very different during the day when you're cleaning up than it is if you go in there at night. Like it's just a different space. It just doesn't feel the same way it did the night before. But you walk into the Camp Nou especially, and you still know it's an incredible football stadium where amazing things have happened. There's something, I don't want to say magical because that's kind of lame, but there's something about it that I found really special being in it, which is why I've done the stadium tour twice. And it's just cool. Like, and the weather's great. Sitting in the stands is awesome. It feels a bit more like watching a theatre game than being in a Scottish or English top flight game where everyone's angry. People are more chill watching it. I just love it.
I think the only people who complain about that have been away fans, say that apparently the away section at Barcelona, and obviously we've never been in the away end, like apparently it's a total mess and the police are like dreadful. Particularly English fans get really, really tough times when they go to the new camp, but aside from that, I totally agree with everything you've just said. I think it's an amazing place.
My only thing is that I find it too big, the Camp Nou. So it's almost like you're almost sitting in like the middle of a city. I don't know how to explain it. You don't feel the tension of a match as much as you do in somewhat of a smaller stadium. I mean, it is, what, 90 or 100,000 people?
Well, that's, another reason that I think, like, my actual favourite would be Pittodrie, because it's smaller and you're closer to it, you feel more attached to it, and it looks run down, there's something special about that you know it's been, you know, it's not been there since 1903, but there's something that's more attached to it. And those small stadiums that you get will mean more to a lot of people who go to them, because there's bits and pieces. But I thought, you can see everything from the Camp Nou. It's
you can,
old and massive, but you can see everything on the pitch. And I think it's the people that are around there, because, I mean, I'm not from Barcelona, so I don't know what it's like to be Barcelonian.
Catalonia.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's been funny. And then, but that's a different kind of culture that watches those sports. And I mean, their normal now is watching a team who should win La Liga and has players of the caliber of, you know, Ronaldo and Messi. Whereas that sort of player doesn't tend to play at a place that will fit 15,000.
Yes, but let the record show, JJ Bull's best stadium ever in the world, Pittodrie, Aberdeen. Thanks very much for joining us. You can be like Robert Crisp, who sent us an email last week suggesting a topic for next week's show, which we will put to the panel. And his discussion that he would like us to have is about the best or worst ever refereeing decisions in a pre-VAR world. You can let us know your nominations for that category and we'll put them to our panel on next week's show. The address is afcpodcast@telegraph.co.uk. Get in touch with your nominations for that or send us another category if you'd like to. You can also contact me on Twitter if you want. It's @TomHGibbs. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast at the Telegraph Audio Football Club, wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Joel Grove on the buttons, and thanks to you for your company. I'll talk to you again soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.